Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest today is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, a national pro-life group of more than 465,000 members. The Susan B. Anthony List exists to pass laws that protect unborn children and their mothers from abortion. The New York The New Yorker magazine has called the Susan B. Anthony List a small but savvy group that has emerged as a leading combatant in the abortion wars. They're best known for their efforts to fund political campaigns for pro-life women and for pro-life men who oppose pro-abortion women in running for the Congress. About our guest, the New Yorker said of Marjorie Dannenfelser, for politicians seeking to limit abortion, Dannenfelser is a valuable link to the grassroots of pro-life activism, a committed activist who understands the art of messaging. Marjorie Dannenfelser, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. I've been so looking forward to this time with you.
Well, me too, actually. And you're not just the president. I mean, that's enough. But you're not just the president of the Susan B. Anthony List, but you're one of the original organizers.
I am. It was a small little group, and we had about $5,000 and about three or four women that really thought this was an important thing to do, to stand for the pro-woman, pro-life cause. And now now our group has got about a $20 million election cycle budget, and we're not in my living room anymore, thank goodness. And God has been good, and with his grace, we've done a lot over a few years.
Yes, you have. And now, so when you started the group, how long had you yourself been a pro-life person?
Wow, I was just an infant when it comes to being pro-life. When I was at Duke, I was the co-chair of College Republicans, and the way they handled the arguments was to have a pro-life and a pro-choice co-chair of College Republicans. I was the pro-choice co-chair, so not only was I that person, but I was known for that, and I was very vocal in my position. While I was there, I graduated in '88, so. Around, it's probably like 87 or something, when I started kind of re-opted Duke Students for Life. So I guess that would be a marker as to when I kind of fully came over. So I was always political. I mean, really from kind of an early age, even though my family wasn't, I really kind of was captivated by what our system gave us to change things. But the pro-life piece was God's timing, came later.
And now, so when you focus now in the group on elections, I know you do other things as well, but do you have measurable success with the congressional? In essence, you're both trying to elect women where you can, and elect pro-life men who will oppose pro-abortion women. What's the success record like there?
Well, we've helped elect hundreds of members of Congress and the House of Representatives, and scores of U.S. senators, and quite a few governors and statewide officials across the country. And it is definitely our founding goal to really to get more women elected in the policy in public office. And because at that time there really was almost nobody.
Yeah.
And if you walked into a room as a woman, everyone thought that they knew what you believed already, just because of the fact that you're a woman. And I worked in the House of Representatives as the director of the Pro-Life Caucus, and I saw that as one of our biggest problems. But I saw as an even more important problem was the fact that the pro-life movement didn't have a electoral muscle, that we didn't have the ability like the NRA or even the tobacco industry, you know.
Right.
Organizations that deserve even less muscle when you really think about it sometimes, that we didn't have that. And that was where the big thing, where my motivation came. It was to create a machine to elect pro-life leaders who would pass laws that would save lives. And the woman piece of this is very, very important. But as we've grown, we also realize that there are going to be quite a number of races where there's not a woman involved. And it's really important for the pro-life movement to weigh in heavily to bring a pro-life man also across the finish line in really tight, especially Senate races across the country.
And you're saying like there was this idea that people knew as a woman that, oh, well, you got to be pro-choice.
Right. Right.
When you're in, you know, you're working in the political arena now, is that still there? Are you, is, for example, is a pro-life woman still seen as a little odd, maybe, or like, wait, what? You know, that kind of thing.
I think that that reality has evolved quite a bit from when I was in Washington in 1988. We have really not just our organization. Certainly, our organization has grown in influence, but also the country has come around in so many ways, and women have come around in so many ways that is really not. I don't think that you could say that with such confidence that you are in a, you know, in an academic setting or a political setting, and a woman walks in, that you know what they're going to think. And I think a piece of evidence for that really is, one thing is that in D.C., pro-life people now are in charge in the White House, in the U.S. Senate, and in the U.S. Congress. And we have a lot of women that we've helped elect. So that is just that is just a reality that there are so many more now that we've helped elect that you wouldn't do that. But then also in my day-to-day life, in talking to mainstream media, which is several times a week, there is a lot more open-mindedness. And I know the mainstream media gets a bad rap that they deserve, but on this particular issue, I come across far more open-mindedness now than I did in 1988. Wow. And that includes whether women are pro-life or pro-choice. And I think there are a lot of good reasons for that, that we could probably guess before I. But certainly, sonograms have made an enormous difference in everyone's thinking, and reporters are still people too. You know, they're still human. And then the Gosnell horror in Pennsylvania, seeing what late-term abortions are and who carries those out. And then also what, seeing finally, after decades and decades of funding of Planned Parenthood, kind of on the inside of what's going on there.
But and yet still we saw these after the election, we saw this march for women kind of thing all over the world. And pro-life women were really consciously excluded. I mean, quite vocally, verbally, out, you know, obviously excluded. What did you think of that? What'd you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think the real difference is there was a very similar march called the March for Women's Lives. I think it was in 1991, and I was a fresh, you know, pro-lifer. I might have even been in 90, but anyway, so it was a given. It was not even a question mark about whether pro-life women would be included in the March for Women's Lives. They were simply not. There's not even a thought about it, and that it would have even been laughable, frankly, in the culture beyond our own, that it would have been about, that it could have included pro-life. But a few weeks ago in the Women's March, it didn't take a lot for a few women to make some noise, including us, but also Students for Life and others, and New Wave Feminism and others, to call out the march organizers for the nonsensical idea that a pro-life woman shouldn't be included in what it means to be a woman in a march. They make very clear that pro-life women were not included and should not come. And with your permission, I'll tell you too, that day I was in the MSNBC studio to be the one voice over about 3 hours of saturation coverage of this march. I sat there. Finally, they put me in a studio and talking to the producer about what we're going to talk about. And I give him my opinion about being women, pro-life women being excluded. And then somebody came in and said, oh, never mind. We don't really need you. So,
wow.
You know, that would have been the counter voice. You know, the only one, I don't mean, there was none on any other network, but at least for a good saturation coverage, 3 hours, that was it. And I think that's a microcosm right now of the only way they get away with pretending that pro-life women don't exist. They just can't. They have to stifle their voice. They have to not include them in the march. They have to look at polls and say they don't exist, which is exactly what they do.
Well, what about I noticed in the New Yorker piece that came out in 2014 as well, there's a kind of pigeonholing that seems to go on, that if you are that kind of woman, then you must be a conservative right-wing Christian. And is is that the case? Or when you're electing women, are you also looking for women, you know, maybe more moderate or, you know, in the Democratic Party, not just the Republican Party, who are pro-life? And are you finding those women? Are they out there?
I think it has become very difficult since Obama was elected president to find pro-life Democrats, period, man or woman. But it is a beautiful and important commodity, so to speak. So the most important quality is that you be passionate and articulate and aggressive in all the right ways on promoting this as a pro-woman, pro-life perspective. Almost every Catholic woman I know, I don't know that I could predict everything they thought about every subject, like immigration or capital punishment or other things like that. So what really does matter is whether they're willing to fight for the most vulnerable human beings every single day of the year.
And many have made the argument that there is a possibility of a healthy liberalism in American politics, one that takes very seriously the liberal kind of tradition of including, not excluding people. But it would have to acknowledge that the unborn are people.
That's right. Though everyone living in the shadows of society, being protected and accepted in the law, should be the goal of that type of liberalism. And I think a lot of us share that, regardless of what our party is. That's what we believe, especially in the church. That model that you described is what used to be among a number of pro-life Democrats. What happened, though, was the political dynamic in the Democratic Party, especially on the federal level, began on the federal level, that where before there was an allowance that you could vote your conscience on certain bills, once Obama became elected, there was no allowance for that at all. The party apparatus was like a sledgehammer on those people, and we're very happy to see them go, as they eventually were unelected for a whole lot of reasons. But so that was there, and that was very beautiful. And I actually think that if the Democratic Party is going to last, it's going to have to realign and get back to that respect for their consciences on something that good people, at least that they can say very good people, can disagree on.
Now, you mentioned their conscience. Can you give us a little idea of what maybe pricked your conscience a bit to move you from that pro-choice Republican leader that you were to now being one of the most important pro-life leaders in America?
I think it was, it's always God's grace, but it's also, and it's people participating in that and really not letting me off the hook. I really had a lot of stupid arguments. In fact, I know pro-choice people that have better arguments than mine was, but I was definitely committed. You know, it was my body, my choice. It might be a person, but it's for me to decide, not you. Again, my body, my choice was about the best that I could come up with. So people, when I was in college, and I met the first Catholics that I ever knew, I met when I came to D.C. for an internship, and just pressing on those questions, and then taking philosophy back at school, and then also, like many are in college, on a spiritual journey too. I was Episcopalian, and I really did love the Episcopal Church, but I thought something was missing. So all those things happening at the same time, and there was a point where I was in an argument with someone, and they kept pressing on what is that? Like, you keep referring to an abortion and all that, but what is it that's actually happening? What is that thing?
Wow.
What is the object of the abortion? And I said, well, it might be, and I remember thinking a lot about this, it might be a person, it might not be a person. And then kind of in my own thoughts, it seems obvious to everyone, I'm sure, but it wasn't to me then, that why would you ever take a chance? And this is not a full-blown pro-life position. This is just kind of getting a little bit closer. Like, would I go into a dark room and shoot off a gun if I wasn't 100% sure that no one was in there? Of course I wouldn't. It took, frankly, it would not have happened without people who probably didn't think they had the best arguments arguing with me and with kindness and without judgment.
But it seems like the way you're talking about it, that intellectual conversion was accompanied by a spiritual conversion in you, or at least that they were happening around the same time.
I think the pro-life piece helped with the other.
Really?
Because the pro-life piece went first. And I think what it did was it just, you know, the doors in my heart were pretty rusty, and it just kind of forced them open a little bit. And then, you know, when you change your mind on something so fundamental, especially because I had been rather vocal on it, you know, a lot of other ideas, the Holy Spirit, all kinds of things enter in. And of course, I was talking to people, most of the people I was talking to were people who had faith, and they were very strong Catholics. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm looking forward to getting to know them and actually over time see if they can still see if they, what their endurance is like, because they just seem like such good people that I kind of couldn't even believe it. And they wore well with time. And it was a beautiful witness, just the way they lived their lives. And it made their arguments more acceptable to me because of the way they lived their lives.
And so I don't remember if we mentioned this at all, but you did come into the Catholic Church at some point. Was that after college?
Mm-hmm. It was after college. And I have to, I can't finish this conversation with you without giving my deep and sincere thanks to Catholic Answers, because it was one of the first places that I went whenever I was challenged, when I was thinking about conversion. I would go to Catholic Answers and read a great, solid, not too long answer. Because as I was doing that, say on salvation or on Mary or other aspects that were sort of holdups for me, or on contraception, I would go to the Episcopal Church. Literally, I remember walking down the street in Georgetown, and going into Episcopal Church, looking for flyers or pamphlets on any of these questions that were just killing me, you know.
Yes.
And Catholic Answers always had them. The Episcopal Church, where they had them, they were not satisfying to me. And so, you know, what a beautiful argument to be having and to know where to go. So I don't think I could have if I hadn't had an intellectual assent. In fact, I know I couldn't have if I didn't have an intellectual assent to the whole thing. And I also had to argue with my family. So.
That's hard too, right? I'm very grateful for your very kind words about Catholic Answers. It's inspiring. And we hear those stories. And the thing is, the Catholic Church does have a kind of solidity on these things. And if you just stay with, I mean, I think that's part of the philosophy here at Catholic Answers, is we're not trying to teach anything more or less than the Catholic Church teaches, but it's powerful stuff.
Yes.
I'll tell you what, though, one thing we hear, Marjorie, is that Mary is an obstacle for many people coming into the Catholic Church. As a matter of fact, it's probably the most common one is, I don't know about those Catholics and Mary. Was that the case for you?
Well, it's funny. Being Episcopalian, and growing up in a rather fundamentalist environment and being an Episcopalian was an interesting combination. There were fundamentalists that I knew that definitely had problems with Mary, but in the Episcopal Church, in the South especially, she was more of a shady background figure. Like you mention her every once in a while, like kind of a little presence, but truly unobjectionable, which is not at all. I mean, I hate even saying those words out loud, because not only is she not unobjectionable, she is a pathway to grace. She's the mother, all the things that we know now now I know that she is. So it was more like, well, what's the big deal? That was really my, like, why is this constant stuff? And it's such a focus. But that was what was an obstacle to me, not because I thought based on theological grounds there was a problem. It was just kind of like, okay, well, it's all about Jesus, so in my personal relationship with Jesus, if she's involved in it, I guess I better know her better. But it took me a long time, because if you don't know your mother as a child and you learn and you meet your mother as an adult, you have to get her, know her as an adult. You're not, you know, how different, you've got children, I do too, that you bond very differently at each stage. But because she is the mother of God, she can overcome so many of those developmental milestones that I didn't get to live with her. But I went to Guadalupe very recently with my son, and we went to a chapel there that I just have to tell you this. I haven't really told anybody about it, except for my son. And I saw this. There was a baptismal font that was built upon a former altar where there were child sacrifices. So there's this bottom that was the old and where child sacrifice, and then the new, which was the baptismal font part of it, the top. And so to me, we looked at that, and the whole, then that one object is the whole conversion from death to life. What she did there, Our Lady did there to move all of those souls from death to life was the whole story. And it was such a gift being involved in the pro-life movement to see such a beautiful thing.
But isn't Mary now in much of the feminist world, but also just the world of kind of modern individualism, isn't she seen as kind of a counter model to what a real woman should be, you know, with both her, well, her virginity and her kind of what's thought of as her passivity, that is, you know, do unto me, you know, that kind of thing. And that what we really want from women is, you know, more individualistic, more assertive.
I know, it's so interesting because I've certainly thought a lot about that, and Pope John Paul certainly wrote so much about it. And I think that that what I always come up with is that she puts the feminine back in feminism, you know, real feminism, where the feminine genius, so to speak, is allowed to live, to roll out in daily life, is as strong as possible. Is the strongest possible woman that could ever be. I think, you know, if you have a worldview that power is the ultimate, and that other people are obstacles to your life and to your attaining of power, then you can see why it would be very hard to understand the power of Mary. But if your worldview encapsulates the whole all of reality, then you can see that her strength. That there is a transcendent strength in being quiet, and in leading without yelling, and including everybody in the embrace, and never seeing another human as an obstacle to success. And you know, the truth is, even if you don't believe at all, you really see how people like that succeed better than the people are obstacles model. You know, and I think a lot of people don't understand why, but I think that's why. To include me is the feminine way, and she shows that better than anybody.
And she does something that I think our culture doesn't want to do, which is to surrender her will to God. That she fundamentally does the thing that is the thing we're all refusing to do, which is say, yes, right. God, your way, not our way.
That's right. It's the problem with monism. If we are all our individual gods, well, then it makes sense that everybody is could be an obstacle, that is our job to overcome everybody else, to accumulate as much power and stop for ourselves as makes sense. If there is one truth, and it's not located only in us, then she can be the pathway to that, and that the way she acts is to participate in the truth, to be enveloped within the truth. And honestly, you know, how many times do we have to learn the lesson that her way makes more sense, to assent to something bigger than oneself is where your real joy comes from. Self-denial is self-fulfillment. you know, because our instincts, of course, take us in all kinds of directions when we forget ourselves, right? But
yes, right.
I think also when you think of political life, who are the people you're really drawn to? I think of, you know, Mike Pence is somebody like that. He is a true servant leader. And I know him very well, and I know that he's a man of great faith and prayer. And it is the call of his life to serve the Lord. And look where it's led him.
Since you mentioned Mike Pence, many people are opposed to the president, Donald Trump, on the grounds that he's been vulgar about women, and even maybe what would be the word sexist or and so
certainly disrespectful. I think we can say that.
Thank you. There you go. Thanks for helping me with that. Okay, so you have this man who appears to be I don't know about currently. But to have been and spent a good part of his life being disrespectful to women, and so how do you as a woman reconcile that? In part because I'll just say this. This is my evaluation, and I don't know what yours is. After a few weeks of the Trump presidency, if you took everything else out of the equation and just said, well, how's this going for the pro-life cause? You'd say, this is a miracle. I mean, that's what you would say, I think. So can you tell me a little bit about resolving that in your own mind?
Well, to me, it was a prudential judgment based on specific commitments. And because in the end, when you have two flawed human beings, as we are all flawed, we had two flawed human beings to choose from. And what you must do in a situation like that is assess one against the other and look down what matters most. And in our work at the Susan B. Anthony List, we began in the primary getting those commitments from all of those candidates. All the 8 bazillion Republican candidates who ran made commitments concretely so that we could use those commitments. And then again, eventually, these were only Trump's commitments. As the central organizing tool of our entire political operation, where we were going door to door to over 1 million and 200,000 doors in battleground states to close the vote gap. And so using those commitments is what means what? It meant that in the end, the ability to get the policy done had to matter more than the offense that I definitely took and definitely my daughters took and I on behalf of all women took. But in the end, the death of a child, or over 3,000 deaths a day, is a big enough issue to try to fix that. Getting those commitments and then rolling them out now is a transcendent one. And honestly, we know what she was going to do, Hillary Clinton. She committed on the stay on the debate stage that there was no one exempt from abortion up until birth. No one. That anyone could. And he made it very clear, not him, that she might find it acceptable, but not him. I think that most people think it is a miracle because there are miracles every day. But there's also very strong and important political strategies that can save us from just a sort of visceral commitment and a pat on the head for the pro-life movement. It has to be very strong. It has to be there are 4 pieces of these commitments that he made. And then it has to be enunciated over and over and over again. I was in the White House a couple of weeks ago, and I've been there quite a few times, believe it or not, since that first day, which shows you that the whole pro-life movement is welcome in the White House, and that he has not forgotten these commitments. When he sees me, he knows what they are. And that is what you want. You want him to make that commitment while he's campaigning and then follow through with that commitment in the Oval Office, which is what he's doing.
And what did you make of the fact that Kellyanne Conway, who I believe I think her title might be advisor to the president or counsel to the president, and then Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, both spoke at the Walk for Life, which even in the Reagan administration, nobody of that caliber came.
Right. Reagan, Bush, neither. And Pence, the first thing he said was something that I know well, is this not the first march I've been to? He and Karen have been to every march over time. It's the reason he ran for public office in the first place. That is very different. There's a generational change going on in politics right now. So many people did get involved in politics because of this issue or this and one other thing. And if you look at the House and the Senate and you do a pro-life interview of all of those people, you will find this happening over and over and again. Not so with Bush and Reagan. And I think that partly it is the positive evolution of where the issue is right now. And Kellyanne, who I've known since I was 27, 800 years ago, she's always been the person that she is right now. She was the only pro-life woman pollster and still is the only one. In the country, maybe even in the world, And she's been to many. She calls herself a rank and file March for Lifer. I mean, that's just who she is. So what I make of it is that there is an incredibly strong team, that Trump is not on his own. Reince Priebus, he was the first chairman of the Republican National Committee to ever march in the March for Life. So it's all kinds of new first things that are very positive. We can't relax. We have to be vigilant. But that there is every reason to believe that this is a springtime in the making for the pro-life movement.
Now, I don't want to just harp on this too much, but when you vote, you don't get a yes but on your vote. You just got to pick somebody and vote for them. But I do want to ask you about, you know, going forward, the message of the dignity of women and the need for a society that is not degrading to women. Some people will read, and I'm not saying whether this is right or wrong, that they will read it this way. There are people who will read the election of President Trump as a kind of step back in the move towards a full dignity of women and women being treated with full dignity in the public sphere.
And those arguments go on in my home. So I'm very, very conscious that we as a church also need to listen to each other and be a part of the healing rather than the division that is right now. So what I really also know from knowing Vice President Pence and from knowing who I know better than I know the president, but I know the president, but I really do believe he's on a journey. Now, that is not good enough, and I realize it. But I do believe he's a better man than he was in that video 11 years ago. But having said that, say he's the same guy, which I don't think is true. But say he were, it means we have to be watching for every step of policy and making sure, and also responding positively or negatively to his comments. We have to continue to stand for the dignity of women and children, no matter what. And as long as he's doing well, we're going to praise him and thank him. If he slips up, we will act like the ally that you should be, which is to come in and correct him and try to do everything we can to make sure it's bent towards the good. The argument that I think fails is one that I think is not measurable. And that is because of the posture or the mood, we have undermined the dignity of women. That this is a step back. Because what you're doing is you're saying that those, in my view, is that if you had voted against him, you'd be saying that the deaths of all these children every day aren't as important as the mood that he has struck in the nation. I think moods can change and messages can change, but you can't get those lives back ever, not for this world. And so I think that we just have to be salt and light and leaven in the bread and do every single thing we can do to turn it toward the good.
Amen, sister. And now let me ask you this. I'm just curious about how this works. In the circles that you run in, one of the things we have not mentioned is Emily's List. But Emily's List and the whole Year of the Woman in the early 90s, where a whole bunch of women got elected to Congress because of Emily, or at least in part because of Emily's List, and every single one of them was a pro-choice woman. And so in some ways, the Susan B. Anthony List is a response to that. Is that fair enough to say?
That's right. That's right. Two things. One is I want you to know why it's Susan B. Anthony. But the other is that their founding at Emily's List, which is, you know, they're in lockstep with NARAL and Planned Parenthood. They have all their meetings together. They were pro-choice Democratic women. That's what they're after. And that was very much at the center of all their campaigning then. But if you look close, which we do, that pro-choice piece, they really don't talk that much about in elections that they are heavily involved in anymore. They talk about every other issue that affects women, but not that one. And I think we know why. Unless they're in a really, really blue place that is very pro-abortion, very pro-choice, they really don't bring it up. it's waned in popularity and it's waned in its power to accumulate votes and win the elections. And that's what we were after. I think that what Susan B. Anthony list does is leverage all of those gains in elections. We're not taking credit for all the gains, but what we have to do is leverage the strength of the pro-life movement in elections so that we can pass laws finally and overturn Roe versus Wade, which Susan B. Anthony and her compatriots would all be for. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Victoria Woodhull, on and on and on. Elizabeth Blackwell, Charlotte Lozier, women who are in medicine, women who are in politics, in all these fields, they took the abortion as an offense against women. And it wasn't just because it was not safe. It was because they understood that it was the killing of children. They were very upfront about it, and it's been written out of feminist history.
Yeah.
Susan B. Anthony said that the act would burden a woman's conscience and life. It'll burden her soul in the grave. But thrice guilty is the one who drove her to the dreadful deed. It's someone who understands what an abortion is.
And so now the Emily's List still exists. And as you said, the mood, though, has changed around these things. I wonder, when you're in Washington doing the work you do, do you kind of end up in the same room with the folks from something like Emily's List? Like, do you know one another, or is it a kind of from a distance thing?
You know, it's better to be in a small town in regards to the answer to this question, because in a small town, you would find yourself in the diner. Oh, yeah, there's, you know, Cecile Richards over there.
Right.
Maybe we should talk. That would be better, because I'm a believer in the ability of people to change and ability of people that to do better when they actually talk to each other. I really mean that. But in D.C., the only time I'm ever in the same room with somebody who's ahead of Emily's List or NARAL or now is in a green room. And I've had some really interesting conversations in those green rooms with heads of pro-choice organizations, some very hopeful and some eye-opening and confirming. But one thing that should never be is that we cut ourselves off from those conversations, and that I really believe that would have been, because look at where I came. My own life is an example of people who took the time to talk to me, even though they found my views to be very obnoxious, and they were right.
Right. Okay. Right. So I have a short time, so I want to get to a few other things. You're kind of, I don't know if it's the mission statement, says that you exist to pass laws that protect unborn children and their mothers from abortion. Mm-hmm. But you can pass those laws and then judges will overturn them. So why doesn't it say pass laws and see that judges are installed? You know, why is that part missing?
Yeah.
Or is that implicit in the whole thing?
Well, it is implicit, but it is also a very concrete thing that must be done by the people that we elect to the Senate and the presidency. There's only one way for a judge to be confirmed, and that is on the federal level, and that is that a president nominates and the Senate advises, and their advice and consent role allows them to be a judge or not. That's why one of those four commitments from Trump was that all Supreme Court and federal judges be pro-life. And so that is very much at the heart of the very obvious strategy. It's also why the Paying Capable bill, that 20-week bill, is the top legislative strategy, because is as mild and modest a proposal as it is, it's the one that could actually save lives based on the fact that children are children and have rights.
Right.
And is more likely than most other, all other legislation to be upheld, especially after we get more men and women on the court,
right,
Supreme Court, that are pro-life.
Yeah, I thought one of the most shocking things of the last election was the interview with Secretary Clinton, where she affirmed her view that an unborn person has no rights. And that reminds you kind of the Dred Scott decision in a way. So do you get the sense that if you can kind of make a beachhead, get any legal acknowledgement of rights for the unborn, then it's a little bit like the D-Day landing, then you bit by bit you can make progress from there?
Yes, and in fact there is such language that we base our strategy on the Supreme Court, that there can be a state interest, can't be an undue burden, but there can be a state interest in the life of the child. And so that, of course, is the wedge that we want to drive between Roe and what a future Supreme Court decision could be. I think that, you know, the already Roe is in tatters. The whole trimester system is not used anymore. It's now based on viability. So the whole idea of Roe used as messaging from the pro-choice world is based on the idea that somehow when Roe is, quote, overturned, that women are going to go in the back alley. There is going to be no abortion.
Right.
That's legal in the whole country. And that's just not accurate. It just means that we'll have the power to actually enact laws that we think are reasonable.
And is that so? If you were going to say to me, if I was to say to you, Marjorie Dannenfelser, how are we going to win this thing? How are we going to return this country to its traditional pro-life footing? And so what are the steps you would outline for me?
Number one, the courts. Number two, legislation that tests and overturns the obnoxious ruling that Roe versus Wade was. And then after that, we'll see how we'll push as far and as ambitiously as we can imagine. We will push, but what we will not will. And so those are the steps. I mean, but they all have to happen at the same time. So think about it. Really, it involves elections. It involves legal strategy. It involves a legislative strategy and grassroots strategy all at the same time. They can't be in succession, or it simply won't work. That's why what we do is to embed all of these commitments into elections so that later who you nominate to the court is already decided, or the type of person that you nominate to the court is already decided. And here's our legislative idea for when that happens. It's all concurrent.
Do you have a sense of greater hopefulness than maybe you did back in the mid-90s or so, that we're getting there?
Without question. I mean, look at it this way. The very strongly pro-life Senate, there's a wide swath of senators that know that the pro-life movement is part of the reason they were there.
Uh-huh.
And so they certainly feel their strength, our strength, but they also are very pro-life themselves. Same for the House and same for the White House and same on the state level in terms of governors. So, what I also find encouraging is that I'm very encouraged on a lot of levels while vigilant, but I'm very encouraged that this idea that somehow there's a division between doing pro-life work in the culture and doing pro-life work in the politics and elections, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It all has to happen. And so I see a coming together of the pro-life movement in that way as well, and that's also encouraging.
And the reason for our defense of life is not at root a religious thing. It's rooted in science and when we know life begins. And but there is a way in which our religious faith equips us to engage in that battle. When I think of you you're doing a service for all of us going on MSNBC, even if they won't let you on camera, there you are in the arena.
One day, yeah.
Do you have the sense when those things happen that you're taking up your cross and following? And could you maybe say something to young people who are afraid to take up their cross and follow in that way?
What I know is that you're never alone doing that. If you think you're alone, then don't do it. he can completely be trusted to help you with the words, help you with the attitude, help you with the kindness. But it's worth doing even if it's done imperfectly. I'm here to tell you I've done it imperfectly for 25 years. And I'm doing the best that I can. And I see tremendous, along with our team and the whole pro-life movement, I see tremendous strides. And where did I learn that from? I learned that from people who were imperfect apostles to me as well. When I'm sitting in a green room with the president of, NARAL, I talk to her as she is, which is a child of God who I disagree with. And do I think that I'm going to convince her in that green room when we go on the show, take a different position? No, but I do know that I can show her that this is not about hate. This is about love, and that we disagree very fundamentally but this is not a personal hatred or loathing that I have towards her or the world of people who don't align with me perfectly. So I think sometimes discouragement comes because we take too much on ourselves. That, you know, it's always going to be all of us. It really is. And I couldn't do it without the church, I can tell you that.
Well, I'll tell you, those of us in the pro-life movement, we owe you a great debt of gratitude.
Right back at you.
Well, thank you. You've been Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Just before we go, could you just tell people, if you want to support the Susan B. Anthony List or you want to know more about it, what are the steps you take?
It's really easy. Just Google Susan B. Anthony List and we'll pop up. We'll be the first thing. There's a lot going on in the Senate right now, so take a look and see what you can do there to help defund Planned Parenthood.
I'm very grateful that you spent the time with us. Thanks so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
I loved it. Anytime.
And thank you to all of our listeners. I'm Cy Killett, your host. We're here every week, so hope you'll continue to join us. Thanks for being with us on Catholic Answers Focus.